The Future Proof Podcast from News Talk.
Proudly supported by Science Foundation Ireland. Hashtag believe in science.
Hello and welcome to Future Proof the Podcast. This is the show where we take a closer look at the world around us. I'm Jonathan McRae. Thank you for subscribing and downloading and rating. If you haven't rated the podcast or if you haven't written a review, we do really appreciate those because they make us feel good inside. So if you haven't written a review of the podcast or given it a thumbs up or rated it, please do. We'd really appreciate it. Right, coming up on this week's program, we're going to be talking about why it seems we may be too heavy as humans to land on Mars. And this could be a major issue when it comes to getting human beings on the planet in the next 20 years. Even though it seems so close, there is one big problem. We'll talk about it in a bit with Philip Metzger from the University of Florida. If you'd like to get in touch with us, you can email us, science@newstalk.com. You can find us also on Twitter. We're at News Talk Science. First, though, as always, we're looking back at the week's science news. And joining me via Skype is Dr. Ruth Freeman from Science Foundation Ireland and from UCD, Dr. Shane Bergen. You're both very welcome. Our first story. This story has to do with parrots and other birds that are adapting, Ruth.
Yes, exactly. And Jonathan, I don't know if you spotted the headline during the summer that Europe can expect to bask in summer temperatures of 50 degrees centigrade, which caused a bit of outrage online.
Yeah.
Because, of course, nobody really comfortably basks in 50 degrees. In fact, I think the offending publication has been changed that Europe can expect to roast in grim summer temperatures of 50 degrees. Probably about right. But exactly like us being very uncomfortable in the heat, animals also get very, very uncomfortable in the heat. And they have very various different ways of cooling themselves down. And one of the ways they cool themselves down is by using their appendages. So things like their ears, their beaks, their limbs to help dissipate heat. And of course, everyone's familiar with the different types of elephants. So we all learn in school that African elephants are the ones with big ears because they live out on the plains with no trees and they have to get rid of heat. So this team of researchers from Australia looked back at different studies that had looked at morphology in animals over the last 100 years. And what they found was a small but measurable increase in different appendages in different animals, and mostly in birds in their beak size. So what they found was about a 4 to 10% increase in beak size in a number of animals. So things like the gangang cockatoo and the red-rumped parrot, who I presume live in Australia, their beak sizes have increased about up to 10% since in the last 100 years.
And so we think this is to do with warming temperatures and them sort of fast forward evolution and trying to manage with that. What's going on?
Exactly. I think we're seeing evolution in action here. And I think sometimes people are surprised. You know, we think of evolution as happening imperceptibly over massive time periods, but it can actually also happen quite quickly. Now of course, and the researchers will say it's impossible to absolutely link this to gradual global warming, because global warming is also going to intersect with things like food supply, water supply. And actually, we know the famous Darwin finches, those with small beaks do less well when there's less rain because there's less food about. So they don't access as much food. But they're also seeing that those with smaller beaks don't do as well in very warm summers in the Galapagos. So obviously, this is something the scientists want to untangle. But certainly there seems to be a very consistent correlation with animals where we know this rule about morphology, you know, appendages being big in hot climates and small in colder climates. It certainly seems to be happening in those animals.
Shane, our second story has to do with perseverance, not the characteristic, but the robot.
Absolutely, which is on Mars. And we have covered it on the show from when it left, when it landed. It's sending up its drones to do sort of aerial shots. And now it's after collecting its first rock sample. This is a really long, long mission. We're not going to see these rocks back on Earth until the 2030s when the European Space Agency and NASA go get them.
What?
And yes, it's that long a mission. But you know what? It's so well planned out, and it's so important that they're doing it because they're after drilling for rock in an area where they know there was a river delta on Mars. Now it's long gone, but there may be fossilized or geological records of life that existed in that area. And so they're painstakingly going around the surface of the crater they landed in to drill holes in rocks and collect them. And they've just gotten the first one. They did try in August to get one, but it turned to dust. So now we have one. It's in the bag. It is literally hermetically sealed in the belly of the Perseverance machine.
Yeah, Mars being one of the rocky planets, Earth, Mars, Mercury and Venus, I think. And we'll talk later about how this dust is a huge problem when you want to land something bigger than a probe on Mars. So they've tried to collect this sample a couple of times and they failed. Why do you think that is? Didn't we know what the surface of Mars was like? How did we get that wrong?
Well, we do know a lot about the surface of Mars, but we, like all of our measurements are based on spectroscopy. So we haven't gone and physically touched many of the things on the surface of Mars. So they've deliberately drilled into what they think is basalt here, which is very hard. And it's left over from volcanic eruptions. The Giant's Causeway being an example of basalt. And so they dug into a rock about the size of a briefcase, and it's like a pencil-like bore into it. And so that's very, very robust rock. So they reckoned that the drilling there wouldn't turn it into dust, because they're drilling into something like the drill size is quite narrow. So like it's quite easy to pulverize the rock like that and just turn it into dust, as you say.
And so is the mission to return this piece of rock 10 years from now? Is that planned?
Yes, absolutely. So it's in the pipeline, but sure, as Ruth would tell you, when it comes to state funding for science missions, it's hard enough to guarantee it for the next 2 or 3 years. So I'm sure that the scientists have a cunning plan in order to attract funding from various governments for 10 years hence.
Right. So our third story, Ruth, has to do with a new treatment for cancer, and it's using mRNA, which people might be familiar with because of the vaccines.
Yes, exactly. So we've all started talking about mRNA, and I suppose what it is, mRNA, is a little
mRNA.
mRNA is a little molecule. It's almost like an interpreter or a translator or a postman that brings the message of DNA to the body to make proteins and do other things. And it's something scientists were interested in for years. And of course, the story of the mRNA vaccine, it's really nice to be doing this story this week, because the two scientists that worked for decades on that technology, really completely unrecognized, this week got a huge breakthrough science prize of about $3 million. So it's fantastic. But the technology that they came up with, they essentially worked out how to modify this molecule. So when you put it into the body, it was able to evade the immune system just for a very short period of time so it could get into a cell and make a protein. But obviously it's using the body's own mechanisms to make proteins. So it's far outperforming other vectors that we use to put things into the body, like viruses and other things. So of course, after the success of the COVID-19 vaccine, they are turning to cancer, cystic fibrosis, and other things. Mm. And this work that was published in Science Translational Medicine is about cancer, and specifically about melanoma. So they've taken their technology and they've used it to put the message, the instructions to make cytokines into the body. And cytokines are, again, little messenger molecules that are a really critical part of the body's immune system. They help to turn up the immune system. They tell your T cells, come over here, there's a problem that you need to deal with. And they've been tried as a cancer therapy before, but they've been problematic because they disappear very quickly when you put them into the body. And if you continue to administer them, they can become toxic. So they've kind of been shelved as a therapy, even though we knew they should work well against cancer. So this new therapy packages the messages for 4 cytokines, and they've used it in 40 mice on a solid melanoma tumor. And in fact, those mice, essentially, the tumor completely regressed with that therapy, down to nothing within 40 days in 17 mice. Mm. They then moved on to different types of tumors, mice with melanoma and lung cancer. And they found even when they injected this therapy into the melanoma, the skin cancer, they also saw massive improvements in the lung cancer. So it's really exciting. And in fact, it's so exciting, they've already started human trials.
So just on this, and is maybe going beyond your knowledge on it, but Is this a rival therapy for CAR T? Because, you know, CAR T and personalized medicine can be extremely expensive. mRNA vaccine is relatively cheap. I'm wondering, is this a potential alternative to that sort of therapy?
I think it could be, although obviously CAR T therapies will be useful for things where there's this genetic mutation where maybe you can't continue to administer, and it would actually make more sense to go in, cut out that damaged bit of DNA, replace it, use that kind of genetic modification technology. But obviously there's bigger risks with that kind of technology. So I think it's going to be a balanced approach, and it may be that it's different for different conditions.
Great. Shane, our final story, it has to do with the annual sort of mock Nobel Awards called the Ig Nobel Awards. It awards scientists for laughing first and then thinking. Take us through some of this year's finalists.
Yeah, a prize I covet so much. Like, I'd love an Ig Nobel Prize. Yes, so these 10 prizes have been announced from Harvard, and I'll give you a flavor of some of them. One was awarded for peace to a professor, David Carrier, in Utah, who tested the idea that men evolve beards to protect their faces in fist fights, which is, yeah, exactly. I don't know how or why he started doing this, but he did. And he published a paper on it with his group and found that there is evidence of protection. What they did was they dropped weights on bone-like material covered in fleece, and they inferred that there was a capacity, unsurprising perhaps, for the bearded face to absorb the energy in a more efficient way than the smooth face. And so, of course, this is a little bit different to Darwin's theory about why men have evolved to grow beards, which is to make them attractive. Of course, Darwin had a big beard. In physics, the prize is given to why pedestrians don't constantly walk into one another, and why some people are very prone to walking into one another. For those that are, they're either extremely vigilant, as in looking just way too much, confusing the other person, or they're not looking at all. So you need to be in that Goldilocks zone of awareness of people around you. In economics, work was shown that obesity is highly correlated with corruption. They looked at the faces of various officials in Central Asian countries who are known to be corrupt, and were able to infer their body mass index from their photos, dodgy, and they were able to look at measures of their corruptness as according to international measures given by the World Bank. And they saw there was a strong correlation there. Finally, in medicine, sex with orgasm is seen as an effective nasal decongestant. And this was originally based on self-observation from the scientists who built a device to measure airflow before and after the event, and found that it is as effective as a nasal decongestant. He did say, however, of course it was a he, that it was hard to get firm data from everyone. People were a little bit distracted. The reason as to why it might work is a combination of excitement, physical exercise, and of course, hormonal changes. There is lots more on the website if you go look up Ig Nobel Prizes.
Thanks very much for that, Shane. I think we'll end it there, shall we? Dr. Shane Berger from UCD and from Science Foundation Ireland. Ruth Freeman, thanks very much. Now, over the last 20 years and over many missions, we have inched ever closer to that day where humans will walk on Mars. But of the many issues that lie ahead in that pursuit, radiation, water, air, there is one that's perhaps less expected. Humans and all the things that go with them are heavy, and that's not good. Here to join us and discuss is Dr. Philip Metzger. He's a planetary scientist at the Florida Space Institute from the University of Florida. Philip, thanks for coming back on. The last time we spoke to you, we were talking about the problem with moon dust and how moon dust is sticky and problematic if you want to land on the moon. I hadn't realized it was as big a problem, if not bigger, for Mars. But in terms of landing, I thought it was now relatively easy to land something on Mars.
Well, so I wouldn't say it's easy to land on Mars. It's
no, sure, but relative to landing big things.
Yeah. So the problem with the dust on Mars is it's another dry planet, just like the Moon is. There's no liquid water to clean dust out of the environment, and so over geological timescales, the dust has accumulated, and it's everywhere. It's in the thin atmosphere. It's all over the surface. And it's abrasive, so it gets into all of your technology, and therefore it's a problem on both planets.
When we spoke last, you told me that there are companies making synthetic moon dust, and this can cost, just for a small amount, thousands and thousands of dollars. Are we doing the same with Mars dust, or can we say, well, dust is dust?
We are creating synthetic Mars soil, synthetic Martian dust. In general, we call it regolith. So we are using the mineralogy that we've inferred by looking at Mars from spacecraft in orbit and local regions of the mineralogy from the rovers that are driving around. Then what we do is we go around here on the Earth and we try to find the same minerals, bring them together. You know, we may have to travel all over the continent to find those minerals. And then we crush them and mix them together and try to create, as best as we can, a simulant of the Martian material.
And so what, remind us of the problem then of this dust. If we want to land something like the Curiosity rover, which is relatively heavy, but not anything like a human load spacecraft, what's the problem exactly with landing on Mars with all this dust around?
Yeah, so I would say it's not just the dust, but it's more generally the soil. You know, the soil includes all the larger particles in the rocks. So the landing problem is that the rocket exhaust, if you want to have rocket exhaust large enough to support a large lander in that gravity of that body, that planetary body, then it's going to be a very effective digger. And it digs into the ground and it blows the soil and the rocks and the dust everywhere. Now, rocket exhaust is going extremely high velocities. For a Mars landing, if you're using methane as your fuel, the rocket exhaust is going about 3,500 meters per second. So the dust gets up to that velocity, and the sand and the rocks, they don't quite go as fast, but they get up to very high velocity, and then they can hit the bottom of your rocket. They can fly out and hit your outpost if you're trying to land near an outpost. And it can also dig a deep hole. And when that hole starts to cave in after you've shut off your rocket engines, then it can sap the soil out from under your foot pads of your lander and cause some tilting in the lander, which could be unacceptable or hazardous to the mission.
Could you not slow yourself down to an acceptable speed higher up so it doesn't disturb the soil?
No, we really can't. We've looked at many different ways of landing on Mars as well as the moon, and there's really no better way to do it. The problem is that on Mars, the atmosphere is so thin, and on the moon, there is no atmosphere. So you can't really rely on parachutes to get you going slow enough for that last part of the descent. So when you're landing, we do come down for parachutes on Mars for part of the way, but it doesn't get you slow enough. And so then you have to turn on your rocket engines for the final part of the landing. Then you've got to keep those engines going the whole way down. Now you can, as a strategy, shut off your engines with a little bit of height left and then free fall that last bit. But you don't want to fall too far because you'll break your rocket when you hit impact. And so, but even so, even shutting off your engines as high as you can, the rocket exhaust reaches all the way to the soil and causes havoc in the soil.
Could you mount, I mean, maybe this would make that much of a difference, but could you have the landing thrusters really high up?
Well, if you look at the pictures that Elon Musk has been producing with the Starship, on the version that they show landing on the moon, they always show on those pictures thrusters that are located high up on the rocket. So people have been looking at this concept, and that does help, but it's not a complete solution. And in fact, that would be a better solution on the Earth than it would be on Mars. On Mars, it doesn't work that well because the atmosphere is so thin on Mars that it doesn't cause any turbulent mixing with the rocket exhaust. And therefore, that little jet of rocket exhaust travels a very long distance, much longer than on Earth. And so even when you're high up with those thrusters at the top of the rocket and tilted outward, those jets go all the way down and hit the ground and dig holes. And then the gas that goes in those holes has to shoot back out of the holes, and you end up shooting dirt and rocks right back at your rocket.
What about layers of material to create a landing pad, doing something like that through flyby, like spraying a foam that hardens or something like that?
Well, we have been looking at how to build landing pads, and I'm fully convinced that we have to build landing pads on Mars. Even on the moon, you can get away without a landing pad, but when you land next to something that's already there on the moon, then you're going to damage it. So for your second landing on the moon, you need a landing pad. But I'm of the opinion that for a very large mission on Mars, we're going to need landing pads. But the way you would do that is you would send a small spacecraft first. The small spacecraft has much less thrust and it can land safely, and then it will set about doing the construction job. So we have been working on technologies to center the soil or to use other native materials to mix together to create something like a concrete. There's actually a whole bunch of different technologies, about 50 different concepts, but none of them have been developed very much. So there's going to be decades of work really to perfect this.
I mean, is that essentially dozens of ferrying missions clicking sort of parts together to make a landing pad, do you think?
No, we think we could do it in one landing. The only problem is that the technology has to operate remotely by autonomous methods, because the time delay to operate from Earth is too long. The radio waves take too long. And so you have to be able to do bulldozing and grading and have that all done autonomously by your robot. Now, right now, we don't have that sort of autonomy. Robots aren't smart enough to be able to do that. And so there has to be development work in the robotics, but also the material science, trying to figure out how to make a competent material that can withstand the high temperatures of rocket exhaust in that environment. So we can develop it here on the Earth and we can test it in a laboratory, but we're not going to trust it until we've actually demonstrated it on Mars, because in the cold or in the minerals being a little bit different than we thought, any of these things could undermine the technology and make the landing pad fail during landing, and that could be catastrophic. So the problem is it's going to take a series of missions to develop the technology, and then finally one last mission to build that landing pad.
Do we have landing pads designed for Mars yet? Are there different ideas on the table there?
We don't have any actual designs for Mars landing pads. We have concepts. And the concepts are not mature yet. So we really need to even down select which technology we want to use. Do we want to try to make polymer out of the Martian atmosphere, out of the carbon dioxide and out of the water on the ground? If we can make a polymer, then we could mix that into the soil and that could stabilize the soil. Another option would be to try to make concrete, but then we have to get the calcium out of the minerals and go through a whole process to make water-based concrete. A simpler option is to simply microwave the soil in order to melt it into a glassy material that's glass with the soil particles all mixed together. That requires a lot of energy though. And so you have to deliver the energy system to Mars, and that could be a lot of mass. And it's a trade-off of how much time, how much mass you deliver, and speed, it's mass delivery, and then it's the capability of the system to function safely. Those are the things we have to consider as we're down selecting to one concept.
And I know Elon Musk is very keen on getting to Mars. Is this something that he is contributing to? Is it a concern of his, how to actually land something heavy like the Falcon Heavy on Mars?
Sure, he's been discussing it recently in an interview. And everybody in the community that's trying to land on the moon and Mars is aware of this and starting to focus on solving it. But, you know, a good program manager and somebody like Elon or the head of the European Space Agency, any of these organizations, they're going to want to try to figure out how to land on these bodies without landing pads. because if you decide to use a landing pad, you have just added several years of additional work into your program. So it really is necessary for them to try to approach it other ways. And they're still in that role of trying to figure out how to land a rocket without a landing pad. I don't think we're going to get there. I think in the end, we're going to end up doing landing pads. But right now, I think they haven't completely focused on landing pads because they're keeping the hope alive for the alternative approach.
Obviously, these agencies are planning missions both to the moon and to Mars. And when we spoke, we were talking about moon dust being an issue in the same way. Are they taking this issue seriously when it comes to Mars? Because when we talked last, you seemed to think that they weren't really considering this as much of a problem when it came to the moon.
There's been progress. Right now, NASA has several projects funded to develop the ability to predict how the rocket exhaust blows the soil. And NASA is doing experiments every day. I have a meeting with them every single day where we go over that day's experimental work to try to interpret what happened with these jets of rocket exhaust blowing holes and blowing craters. And we're seeing all this phenomena that we can't understand. And so, but we're working on it, trying to make progress. And we recognize the fact that as we're solving the physics for the moon, this does feed forward to Mars. So we keep saying moon, then Mars. And this is a case where that philosophy really does work. We really are going to solve the problems on the moon first. But we've got to be careful. We don't want to use a solution on the moon that only works for the moon. Like if you rely on solar concentrators to focus the sunlight to melt the soil into a landing pad, that could work great on the moon. But at Mars, you're farther from the sun and the atmosphere is very dusty. And then you have seasons, a very long winter where the sun is low on the horizon. And so that would not work. So we need to make sure that we choose technologies that work for both planetary bodies. Now, as far as solving it for Mars, I really think that's a bit further out. The architectures that I have seen for Mars missions do not include precursor construction missions. So I think the agencies are not going to adopt the strategies until it's really been proven that they have to. Right. You know, there's a political side to this too. You have to continually promote the goodness of the mission. And so you're not going to go around talking about the problems all the time. We're going to be talking about the benefits.
Who knew rocket science was so hard, Philip? I mean, you make it sound so complicated. Let me finish up by asking you, do you think we'll see humans operating in Mars at you know, longer than a few days, you know, months at a time? Do you think we'll see that in the next 20 years?
I think it's possible. I think 20 years is at the beginning of the window where I would expect it to happen. Okay. I don't think we're going to get there before 20 years, and it might actually take 30 years, but I think we are on a trajectory right now. We've got a lot of organizations that are focused on getting us to Mars. The technologies are making dramatic progress. The cost of space flight is coming way down. As the cost comes down and more activity occurs in space, the economy of the space environment will improve and it's going to be a virtuous cycle. And so I think we are on the trajectory to get to Mars soon.
Really fascinating, as always, to speak with you, Dr. Philip Metzger from the University of Central Florida. Thanks for your time.
My pleasure.
It is really interesting to chat to someone so enthusiastic about dust. Even if it is interplanetary dust. Okay, let's look back at some of your comments from last week. We talked about Otto Warburg, who is a really interesting character in the mid-20th century. He was a gay Jewish scientist who lived right under the nose and pretty much with the blessing of Hitler, despite his supposed weaknesses of being gay and Jewish in his eyes. And he did so because his science was brilliant and he was recognized for his cellular science when it came to cancer. Really interesting story. And we have a text on that saying, why is it that the 21st century fascists are invariably gay, especially bisexuals who think non-gay people are inferior? Okay, lots of sweeping generalizations there. I can't think of a 21st century fascist who is openly gay. think there might be one, but I would say invariably has got to be wrong. And if you are assuming people are gay because they are exhibiting some characteristics you don't particularly like, well, that's your problem. And bisexuals who think non-gay people are inferior, well, I think, you know, probably doesn't deserve much of a response. Roisin says, would it not be true to say that white Europeans have had a notion of their own superiority for nearly 2,000 years? It didn't start with Hitler and Nazism. It just crystallized and became more public and active under that Reich. A great program. Keep it up. Roisin, you're absolutely right. I mean, you think about the conquistadors and the various enslavements and conquering the crusaders. White Christian superiority in Europe is very old and well predates the Nazis for sure. We were talking about neutron stars, these fascinating things that have just mind-bending physics. And John from Navin says, is a neutron star kind of a halfway house to being a black hole? And that is a good question, John. From what I can figure out online, a neutron star only forms with smaller sorts of stars because they're not big enough to fully collapse into the black hole state. So you'll never have a really large star, say 10 times the mass of our sun. That'll never collapse into a neutron star because it just it's too unstable. Whereas if you have a smaller star, it will when it explodes, it can go into this neutron star. And then we were talking about consciousness and consciousness in animals, and someone says, what about a jellyfish? But that's all they've said, and I don't know. Don't know quite what to do with that question. Maybe you have an answer. You can email science@newstalk.com your questions or reactions to this week's show. But that's it from us for this week's program. Thanks to Aidan McKelvey, who is producing, Simon Keane, JJ Clark, Garrett Mulhall, and Steve McClune, who is on sound. We'll be back with more Future Proof in your podcast feed on Tuesday, where you can hear a repeat of that moon dust piece to go with this week's Mars dust, which they don't overlap as much as you might think. But they are both very, very interesting pieces in a weirdly nerdy way. Check it out next Tuesday. In the meantime, stay curious.